Baby, you are gonna go broke showing turkeys like these.
It's turkey time. Gobble, gobble.
I gotta talk to you.
You won't let go of it, will you?
I saw what I saw.
Psychotics are more active when the moon is full. And this guy's a psycho. When they catch him, you're gonna find out he's just as human as you and me. You have got to get this idea out of your head.
There are no such things as werewolves. The Bible tells us to fear the terror of the beast.
I want you to turn this into a silver bullet.
Heck, you're gonna shoot a 44 bullet at anyway. Maybe not a silver.
How about a werewolf?
The moon is full. You better watch it.
I think he's going to come after me.
Are you ready?
You see how all things serve the will and the mind of God. You see? You meddling little...
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Let's Talk Turkeys. I'm your host, Movie Miss, and I'm being joined this week by my co-host, Drive-In Dave. How are you doing today, sir?
Pretty good.
So are you excited about the film we're covering this week? With spooky season upon us, I felt it was a good fit.
Yeah, I'm actually excited. I grew up watching this movie.
Before we get any further into the discussion, let's bring in our guests waiting in the wings so patiently. We are being joined this week, everyone, by two of the three co-hosts. From the UK, all the way in, flew in just for this episode. From the podcast, The VHS Abyss, I'd like to welcome Matt and Dave. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello. How are you doing?
Are you feeling good? How was your flight? Are your arms tired?
Exhausted.
I'm sorry. That's a bad joke. I know. It's a dad joke.
I can't believe you said that.
Well, I'm glad you guys wanted to join us on this. If you want to tell the listeners a little bit about your show, I would love that. And then maybe that you were going to discuss this movie, but you didn't get to it. So I'm glad we're doing it on our show.
Yeah. So we're just a group of friends, known each other for about 20 years. Every time we've got together, it's always been discussing movies. We're all big movie lovers. Chris and Matt are both a bit more, they're a bit more
involved in
they've been fans that they've been members of film clubs and groups and stuff like that for years. I'm more a bit more casual than they are, but like I say, it's all we ever talk about. So it just seemed a no-brainer to give us an excuse to get together and talk about the films that we grew up watching and, yeah, hopefully discovering new films and some hidden gems that we'd missed. And, yeah, it's been a blast so far. It really has. It's really been fun.
Yeah, I think, obviously an idea of mine. We obviously discuss films a lot. I grew up from my dad introducing me to really random films at video shop, and it's kind of stuck with me. I've always had that love for it. I'm a VHS collector myself, and so I was just like, you know, we discuss films a lot. Let's just chat shit about like stupid films from that period. And it's also a bit of an education to Dave and Chris in a way, because I've seen some random stuff, and it's great having their reaction for the first time to a lot of these films. And so, yeah, it's like we'll watch films we've not seen before or just like films that we absolutely love growing up. So, yeah, it's a cool podcast, and we'll try and pour a few facts and bits and bobs in there, you know, just for laughs, like, so just drink beer and talk about movies.
Right up my alley. I love your show. If you could let everybody know, what are your feelings about this film just as a whole? Like, what is your relationship to it, and why did you want to cover it?
I'll admit this was a first-time watch for me. I was never big on horror movies when I was younger. I actively avoided them, gave me too much anxiety. I really was. And so coming into them now, and I've got better, and as I've got older, I've revisited stuff. I've seen some of the main franchises, the Friday the 13th, Freddy Krueger and things like that, well aware of it. But yeah, discovering films like this, and this one in particular, the reason I think I grabbed this opportunity with both hands, it's the little gems, aren't they? They really are. They, when you have little to no expectation of it, they could just take you on a journey, really. Yeah, I really enjoyed the experience of watching it, and it just reinforces the fact some of these old movies are just classics, hidden gems.
Yeah, so the original idea, though, was that we were planning on a 4th of July episode, you know, to celebrate our like friends from over the sea and stuff. And it was like, well, the one that stands in my mind is Jaws, full 4th of July theme movie, great to review something like that. And then was like, so what can we actually, like, what other films do we know that's 4th of July? So they were coming out with, like, Born on the 4th of July, like, Tom Cruise and all this stuff. Dave obviously started looking up on Google. It's like films that are themed around it. And I think in this movie, after watching it, I still don't know where it is, but I think they must mention 4th of July at some point. And that was like, all right, yeah, okay, it's an excuse to watch this. After all that, we ended up missing the date completely because my dog got poorly and lots of stuff, holidays, and so the date went, and we had to change our episode in the end anyway. So I'm glad we actually got to sit and watch it after all. So thank you.
Oh, me too. I'm so happy you wanted to do this. It's been in our binder for a while, taking time to get to it. So let's jump in. We're covering it on our show because it is a turkey. It has a Rotten Tomatoes critic score of 41% and an audience of 56. So everybody doesn't love it like I love it, and I'm okay with that. I'm surprised that it had such a high critic score. I mean, 41 to me, that's high for a B-horror movie, honestly.
Yeah, totally. Like I say, it didn't do like too well and stuff like that. So yeah, that's about halfway. That's not bad going.
Some people did go see it. It had a budget of $7 million, and it did $12.4 million domestically here at the box office. So even though they didn't recoup their money in studio standards, because they like to make three times the budget in order to break even, I feel like 12 is respectable. Like, some people went to see it. I didn't. Because I was too young.
It was a couple of years after me, I was far too young for that, I'm afraid.
Were you big, Matt, at going out to see horror movies when you were like in your teens and such?
Personally, I tend to enjoy the horrors more at home. Like, that was my preference. On another podcast, I was asked about what was like the horror, potentially like the first horror I've seen in the cinema or whatever. And looking back, I can't even remember, to be fair. I think it was like well into my like nearly 20s when I actually went and watched. It might have even been some like Hollow Man, Kevin Bacon or something. Like, yeah, it was like I never saw it to my heart. Like, I love horror, but I think it was because I love this straight to video stuff rather than the big kind of releases. You know, they were a lot more fun. So yeah, I think that was probably why. So yeah, I don't really tend to watch a lot of horrors at the cinema. Yeah, weird preference. Okay.
So Drive-In Dave, what about you? When's the first time you saw this?
I think I saw this in middle school, because I remember I was kind of getting into the werewolf genre. And I just seen The Howling, and me and a bunch of buddies of mine were making fun of The Howling because, you know, they look like giant fucking rabbits, basically, like, you know, like these huge ears. I was like, I don't remember ever seeing a werewolf with these giant ears. I was like, what is this, like the Trix rabbit coming after people or something? And so we ended up watching this one, and we're like, okay, we actually found werewolves that looked worse.
The werewolf in this movie, oh my God, it looks like a big teddy bear.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get into a discussion about it.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, now I'm going to picture like Teddy Roxpin on like meth or something.
So Silver Bullet was directed by Daniel Attias, who mostly does TV. He did Buffy episodes of The Wire, The Walking Dead. This was his film debut, but still working. I think this movie, because it's based on a Stephen King property and screenplay by Stephen King, it has that, I hate to use the word curse, but all the movies that King seems to adapt himself seem cursed because his stuff doesn't translate, in my opinion, well from novel to screen when he writes it himself. I feel like when other people adapt his work, it works a little better. because they tend to change things and not be so stubborn and stuck in their vision of what they wrote in the novel like he can do, if that makes sense.
No, yeah. Totally. I believe, like, it's a strange one, because can't see why he is obviously adapting his own books. Like, for instance, with this one, he changed his actual story from his book to fit the movie. So, like, you know, it was like the way the werewolf was, because in the book, it actually spoke words in a growly, like, voice. And so, but he didn't want that in the movie. So it's just strange how he kind of, like, has these two visions of his own work, if you get what I mean. He's obviously done other stuff like Pet Sematary, and he did like Creepshow, and some of the screenplays is actually done. It is minimal, but yeah, even Maximum Overdrive, I mean, it was like off his head on coke doing that whole film.
Well, that's what I'd be intrigued. Was he still on the coke when he was doing this screenplay? Or
well, I mean, 83, 84, you tell me. Was that the year I didn't see Maximum Overdrive?
Maximum Overdrive for me, when I first saw this, it was on Sci-Fi Channel in the UK. It was on, we used to have a movie at 9 p.m. every night. It was always this, and it was rotated with about two other films. So it was on like three times a week. It was just cheap kind of channel at the time. But Maximum Overdrive, that's just one film that stuck in my head. My dad used to record a lot of films late night, and I'd watch them in the morning. I'd come back from school and stuff. It was really cool like that. But it just stuck in my head with, I don't know if you know much about the kind of like the story, and obviously there's lorries that are like possessed from a comet or whatever, and one's got a giant green goblin face. And it's just so distinctive, and it just stays in your head. You know, it's like kind of almost like the leader of these lorries. And it's got a pumping soundtrack by AC/DC, a lot of original songs by them, like the opening to it. So, yeah, it was like, then looking back, knowing that Stephen King was like at his peak on cocaine, it was just, you can completely see it. Like, you know, it's absolutely crazy. So, yeah, like you say, I mean, is this the start of, like, you know, him being off his tits on coke, you know?
Well, let me throw that over to you, Dave. I see you smiling there at all this. What is your opinion on the direction of this film? This is a first-time director. How did you feel watching it? Because this was also your first-time watch.
No, the production value and everything really came across. Well, I felt intrigued by the story from the start. It sort of pulls you in. I did find it sort of clashed with themes at times. It felt like it didn't know whether it wanted to be in a similar vein to like Monster Squad at times, with the plucky kids and teenagers. But then you've got this sinister backdrop of all these brutal murders. Like, we get the murder straight from the off, and it sets the tone well as a horror. But yeah, I think it being a Stephen King book fan growing up as a teenager, that did feel familiar. It felt familiar to me in the way it was introducing this small town. I used to love Needful Things and Dark Off, that are all set around that main area. So it did feel familiar to me. I wouldn't have questioned that this was a directorial debut in terms of a motion picture. So, yeah, I thought it was good.
Real quick, though, I want to bring up how he brought up Monster Squad. That's actually funny, because I was thinking that the whole time with the werewolf, and then like when they're making the silver bullet and everything, that it just, it didn't hit me until this watch around that it's like, oh my God, this does kind of feel like a cheaper version of the Monster Squad. So I love that you brought that up. That's actually hilarious.
Yeah, we don't know if this wolfman had nards. We don't know.
Oh, thank God we don't know.
So one interesting bit I came across when doing research was that Phantasm franchise director Don Coscarelli actually was the director for this film originally. He shot all or most of the non-werewolf scenes and then quit the movie because they were in a dispute over werewolf design, if you can believe that.
Wow. That's interesting as well, like, because I think if it just stays... Because Phantasm, that's just a massive trippy film, isn't it? I mean, anybody, if you tell anybody, watch Phantasm, you'll guarantee, like, for the first time, you'll guarantee that they'll come to you and like, you know, literally want to probably set you on fire or something, because first time I literally watched that, I was like, what's all this hype, Phantasm? You know, I've got to watch it. And I come away thinking, what the frigging hell have I just watched? I definitely prefer the sequel. That's for definite. But yeah, seeing it through his eyes, I'd definitely be interested to see, especially how he direct Busey as well, you know, and the chemistry they'd have on set, because, yeah, obviously he did a lot of ad-libbing in this film and stuff, and whether he'd allow that. But the style of Phantasm, right, in this movie, that would be very interesting. Yeah, it's a strange one. But at the same time, I think Dino De Laurentiis was involved. And he sounds like a real piece of work from stuff what I've heard from other actors and directors anyway. So, yeah, I can see why there will probably be a bit of a clash going on. You know, I mean, I read the Schwarzenegger biography, and he had some massive, like, bust-ups with him, with his contracts and other films. He was trying to, like, conned him out of... Just to cut short, Schwarzenegger had a big beef with him over Conan the Barbarian. De Laurentiis wanted him to do another one, and he was like, no. And he was like, oh, just coming in a cameo on Red Sonja. And he's like, right, okay. And then he ended up basically becoming like a second main actor in the whole movie, and Schwarzenegger didn't even know about it. And it was just like, you know, so he was like a bit of a dodgy dealer, basically, it sounds a bit. So, I think there's a lot of filmmakers and actors that have had beef with De Laurentiis, to be fair. So, yeah, real piece of work.
Well, I have beef with him because he's the reason that the werewolf looks like a giant teddy bear. That was the sticking point for him. And Coscarelli was like, no, I want a menacing, frightening wolf. And so, yeah, he left. I'd be curious to see if that footage is out there somewhere.
Yeah, it's interesting when you hear like some backstories of like the wolf suit and how it wasn't even ready in filming and all this. And it sounded like a hell of a shoot, almost custom with De Laurentiis. Yeah.
So you mentioned Gary Busey. Let's jump to the top billed cast. We have Mr. Busey as Uncle Red. We have Everett McGill, Corey Haim, Megan Follows, Terry O'Quinn, Robin Groves, and Leon Russom. And we can talk about them as we jump into the walkthrough. But I did want to mention Busey, like you said, a lot of his stuff ad-libbed. They let him do several takes. And there's even one scene, which we'll get to, where there's a goof in the movie and they just left it in because it works. It's on brand with Uncle Red.
Yes.
I just totally want an Uncle Red, like as long as it's Busey for myself.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I love him in this.
Totally. You can just see, you can imagine, like, as Corey Haim, I don't know how you pronounce his surname. You can just see him, his responses to him. It's almost like he's just like having a ball, isn't he? Like, you know, just for all the Buseyisms that he's coming out with, stories. And it's like, you know, it must have been amazing for him on set with him.
And this is pre motorcycle accident, too, because that wasn't till 88. So we're still getting like peak quick-witted Busey, which I love.
Oh, totally. It sounded horrific what he went through. And he's obviously got some sort of brain damage now, like, you know, because he almost obviously died, didn't wear a helmet. Oh, a bit crazy. Yeah, Busey. I mean, he's nearly 80. I mean, like, enough respect to the guy. He's absolutely crazy. Like, you know,
but in the best possible way.
He's turned it into an amazing career. I mean, like, you will watch him just to see, like, what the hell is he going to do? And that's just brilliant.
Yeah, he's my favorite performance from him is definitely from Under Siege. He's just acing that. So him and Tommy Lee Jones, and they just make that film for me. It's perfect.
Agreed. All right, yeah. So let's do the IMDb plot for this. I always like to go to IMDb because anybody can write them. And so sometimes they're great, and sometimes you scratch your head. So this one says, in a small town, brutal killings start to plague the close-knit community. Marty Coslaw, a paraplegic boy, is convinced the murders are the doings of a werewolf. So on the nose, pretty much, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That explains it straight to the point.
All right. Let's jump into the walkthrough because there's a lot to discuss. So our movie begins with the Dino De Laurentiis Presents. And I got excited because he's like a Roger Corman to me. When I see his name pop up, I'm like, ooh, goosebumps, here we go. Then we get Stephen King's Silver Bullet title card right away. And we get, this is the thing you had said earlier, Dave, the tone of this movie. It's tonally all over the place. It doesn't know if it wants to be a comedy or a horror movie or a family drama with relationships between the brother and sister. You don't know what this movie's trying to be. The music in this opening is representative of that, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
That was one thing I noticed. It opens up almost like some sort of Walt Disney family movie, like Bigfoot and the Hendersons or E.T. or something. You know, it was, you know, it totally did not set the tone for the movie at all. It took me a bit by surprise. It definitely weren't sinister in any way. It was a strange score.
We get a shot of a full moon and credits start to roll and that music continues. So again, you don't know what you're in for. You think it's a horror movie, but the music sounds pretty whimsical and light.
It could be like Disney presents Silver Bullet and like the werewolf comes out and like the dress and starts singing, you know.
A different film, but arguably one I would probably watch.
Yeah.
So we get narration now, which listeners of the show here know that I'm not a fan of that. I don't want you to tell me about the movie. Just show me. But we get it throughout this film. We get grown-up Jane, and that's actually a different actress. It's not Megan Follows who does the voice. And I'm not even going to attempt her name because I know I would butcher it. Tova something or other. I apologize, ma'am. But anyway, so she's doing the voiceover and she's telling us basically what's happening from scene to scene when the tone wants to shift in the movie. So she's saying our horror for our town started that night. And, you know, things because of the full moon. And she just kind of intros in a pleasant voice. It's nothing that says this is going to be a horror movie. It's very weird. She says the last full moon. Now, okay, this is a beef I have with this film. And you guys can chime in on this too. The timeline for this movie is completely off. We get words on the screen that says 1976. And then if you look at the sets, the costumes, the cars, everything looks 1984, 85 when they're filming. It's like, why even bother saying it's supposed to be 76? Does that ever come back again? I don't think so.
I'm quite intrigued, actually. Like, so was that the year maybe the book was written? I mean, is she just reading lines from the book itself? Is that where it is? Because I don't really understand all that.
I think that was something that they decided in production that they just thought, pick a random year to set this in. Someone drew 1976 out of the hat because it is ridiculous. It
makes no sense whatsoever.
I just see him sitting around in production going, well, just pick a year.
I kind of see him like just hanging out, like trying to put the movie together and all just like smoking weed or something. Like, dude, I remember like I got this really good weed back in 1976. Like, oh, man, that's when we should set this movie.
And then the wolf man, it could look like a big teddy bear came to life. Oh my God, it's all making sense now. So we see a man out by his lonesome in the dark on railroad tracks fixing something. And for a split second, because this was a mid-80s horror movie, I was like, is that Buck Flowers? That might be Buck Flowers. Do you guys know who I'm talking about?
No, it's the first one for me. I'm not sure who Buck Flowers is.
It's not him. He shows up in almost all of John Carpenter's movies throughout the 80s. He's always like the homeless guy or...
Yeah, I know. You know what? Now you say it. I think I have that exact same response. Like, yeah, it was just a drunk, isn't it?
So then we get a part here. This is another thing that a lot of, in my opinion, bad, poorly written movies do is characters, because y'all don't do this in your real life. I know you don't. Walk around just narrating everything to yourself.
In between singing a beer commercial as well.
Well, it is called Silver Bullet.
I'm not going to knock that because, you know, there's a couple times where I'm like, you know, hopping out of the shower and just start, you know, talking to myself, narrating my life and just being like, oh, drying off and just done my hair.
You do not.
You don't
if
know
your life
me.
Was written by Stephen King, maybe.
That's it. I mean, you've obviously got a lot of time on your hands. You know, he's obviously working on his own, doing the shit shift, you know, and it's like, what else? He's obviously tanked up. He's been, you know, caning summit before his shift or like probably during it as well. And, you know, he's just rambling how rubbish his life is. Yeah, it could happen, I suppose.
But who are you to judge this man for talking to himself? That this is terrible.
I'm me. I judge everybody. That's why I have this show.
Yeah.
But what cracks me up is here we get a tonal shift again. The music turns menacing and we get the feeling and we see someone is probably watching him from the, what would you call it? The sight line of the wood, like the woods, the edge of the woods right nearby. And then you hear like, I love this. The wolf, every time it's wolf cam, wolf vision, it's Darth Vader breathing. Yeah. Did you guys notice that?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it does that a lot.
Yeah, it's like, oh, okay, this is wolf vision because it's Darth Vader. And then suddenly he sees wolf prints in the dirt and he's drunk, I guess. So it takes him a second to realize what he's seeing. And then his head just gets lopped clean off with one swipe of this bear paw. It is terrible, but it's also fun because we get to see the aftermath. We get to see the decapitated head. I appreciated that.
Absolutely. The thing that I'm quite intrigued by, though, looking back, he saw the footprint and he went, oh, shit. Like, almost as if to say, like, is it potentially things that have happened already? And it's almost like, oh, bollocks. That's a really big paw print. Like, oh, crap. Like, he's coming for me almost, or that's, you know what I mean? So whether he meant it like that or what, and I'm, you know, giving it much more credit than it deserves, but it just definitely seemed like he was like, oh, crap, that freaking werewolf's here. I'm just going to get my head slashed off. So
they don't establish, but I feel like maybe they live in bear country.
Because yeah.
But I mean, because like you said, he seems put off by it, but not scared to death like it's a werewolf. Like maybe it's just he's like, oh, an animal print. Uh-oh. He doesn't get to think about it long because he loses his head.
I kind of wondered like, well, maybe he saw the footprint and then he realized it was the werewolf. And he's like, oh, shit, I owe the werewolf like $20 and he's here now. And it's like coming after me. It's like, I thought I outrun this motherfucker. And then like now he's here.
More narration now. Reveals over, this is so weird, we get her pleasant narration over decapitated head. that reveals, everyone assumes because he was the town drunk that it was an accident.
Yeah, that's what I wrote. I went, what? Yeah, decapitation was an accident. How? In absolute capital letters question mark. So how can there be such a scene where he like literally just falls onto like a track, but bearing in mind that his whatever it is, his vehicle,
wagon's still on there, yeah, isn't it?
The wagon thing is still on the tracks, so it's like even if a train did come, it'd be hitting that first, or yeah, it was just so easily brushed to a side where it's like, it's an accident, he's lost his head. Oh, never mind, you know, like, that drunk old twat again, like
the claw marks. Clearly, it was a train.
Well, and what about the actual footprints that scared him in the first place? Like, surely they're still there in the sand.
I think that the wolf watches CSI and he knew to blur out the footprints in the dirt.
That's what I was going to go with. I think, like, the werewolf obviously has connections. So, again, like, there's more to this story. There's a lot more. Like, there's the werewolf has some behind-the-scene connections just covering up the murder.
I was just going to say, whether it is, this is just some clever foreshadowing and we're just being introduced to how inept this local police force really is, because we get to see that pretty much throughout the movie, don't we?
Yes, the crack police work that happens in this film.
That's actually a really good point. I didn't think about that, but like now looking back on it, yeah, that really shows you how crappy these cops are.
So we cut to more narration over a shot of a picnic scene for the small town unfolding. It's a place that I want to be. I mean, I love small town barbecues, everybody's outdoors playing games, there's like the high school marching band is playing, like this is like, I don't know, I want to go to this town. I mean, not if there's a werewolf, but I do think they set the scene well.
So the place it was filmed at, Wilmington, North Carolina, I don't know if it's near any of you guys, it's actually home of Screen Gems Studio. It's like the third biggest production studio in America. It's used for a hell of a lot of movies. The Conjuring was filmed there, the Crow, I Know What You Did Last Summer, and it's also like, so Stephen King's got like a massive connection with that, so it was also used for filming Firestarter, Cat's Eye, Maximum Overdrive. So yeah, some proper like sought after little town like, for like horror and stuff.
That is really cool. And that makes sense. North Carolina and Georgia and places that are in the South like that, which is far from where Drivin' Dave and I are. But we see that all in the movies all the time. And I know they get nice tax breaks for filming there as well. So that might have something to do with it.
That's it. Yeah.
So this town is Tarker's Mills. And I love that she adds a town where everybody cared about each other as much as they cared about themselves. You don't hear that in today's movies.
No.
Everybody's minding their own fucking business now. Yeah. So Jane says in the narration, she was nearly 15 and her brother Marty was 11. And then we see them all kind of sitting in the crowd there waiting for the show to begin. And just looking at Jane, I thought she was a little younger than 15, but it made sense because she wasn't driving. And I thought, what an interesting choice to make her the older sibling and like caretaker to her younger brother. In a horror movie, sometimes that works. You want like a good bond between your main characters because then you give a shit what happens to them.
Yeah.
But in this film, I wasn't believing their chemistry. I don't know how you guys felt about that. So maybe you all can chime in. But I didn't buy their chemistry in this. I didn't feel like they were brother and sister, unfortunately. That part didn't work for me, even though I love this movie.
Yeah, I'd agree on that, actually. That was the only sort of relationship that didn't sort of hit.
Yeah, I'm going to go the opposite, to be fair. I think it was like, I felt really sorry for the little girl, to be fair, because her parents were freaking bone idle. I don't care what anyone says. It was like, they got her doing everything. I mean, it's like, go and find your brother and all this. And it's just like, you know, she's there, like, just enjoying herself, you know, like, our old boss used to say 13, she was supposed to be 15 in the film. And she's having to go wandering off for her brother, and she gets all of that shit gone to like that Brady, like, you know, his mate. I felt like it started ropey, but I think as they definitely got more of a bond, like as the film progressed, like that's how I saw it. There were some nice kind of sentimental moments, to be fair.
That's all nice and fine, but. Dave, you agreed with me, so let's go with yours.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. For me, I just felt like she's just annoyed with him, which makes sense because, Matt, you just said she's kind of his primary caretaker. The parents are assholes and make her do everything. But to me, yep. That's how it came off, is that she was annoyed with him, not like loved him like a brother. She just was pissed all the time at him, and I didn't like that.
I kind of agree that, I mean, I thought the bond gets better later on, but yeah, in the beginning, it starts off a little rough, and I can understand why, you know, taking care of your brother and stuff like that. And the way that the parents were, it did seem a little harsh. I mean, you know, I kept waiting for the scene of go wipe your brother's ass. Okay?
That's the unrated cut. We didn't get that version. So the stage is coming together. We've got the sheriff is up there. The reverend is up there. Some random townspeople, the town bully, will come to learn who he is in a little while, are all sitting up on the stage. And like you said, Jane gets told to go find her brother. This makes me laugh because, again, she's walking off, pissed off, has to go find her brother. And she's mumbling to herself out loud that Marty is a booger. So as soon as she said, as soon as this 15-year-old, we all cursed. I know y'all did. Don't even try to say you didn't. And she's at 15 going, he's a booger. So I immediately went and looked up the rating on this movie. I'm like, is this PG-13? What is happening? Yeah. It's an R-rated movie. And they repeatedly say the word booger as a bad word. I was like, oh, no. Stephen King.
I know. And I don't believe that one bit because I've seen a lot of Stephen King movies and I've read some of his books, not all the way through. I've seen what language he uses in them. So I do not believe that he wrote that as a curse word for a 15-year-old. There's no way. I think her parents were still on sidelines and I think she was giving him some shit.
So we cut now to Marty and his best friend, Brady, and they find a snake over by the trees and they're playing with it. Which I'm glad they say what kind it is because I was like, that is wildly unsafe. To just be manhandling and tossing a snake around. And then Jane comes by and Brady hatches a plan. Marty goes along with it. She comes over, they chuck the snake at her and scare the crap out of her. She falls down. And then as she's getting up, they throw it like right in her lap and she falls in a puddle of mud. Now, I don't like that Marty is blamed for this because Marty is in a wheelchair. So even if he wanted to stop Brady, realistically, could he? I think the sister's being a bit of a bitch holding it against Marty.
Yeah, I think it's one of them, isn't it, where she was maybe like blaming him maybe for egging him on in some way or something. But yeah, thinking back, I had to laugh thinking he's gone into the tree on purpose knowing that he can't get to him to stop him in any way.
Well, you all were young boys. I was not a young boy. Is that something that you would do you think?
I don't think I'd have thrown a snake. quite happily climbed the tree. But we also see that Marty is quite adept at tree climbing later on, don't we? So we might have been able to wrestle him off the ground.
Holy shit, I didn't think of that. That's a great point. He does climb it later when his kite is in jeopardy. That's important.
I mean,
smallest tree.
No respect to him. I'm in total awe of his upper body strength. I've got to say, like
11.
Exactly. I mean, that was some distance. I mean, obviously, we'll get to that, but wow, I was in like real awe of him. I wonder if they had to give him like some sort of training regime to, you know, to bulk up for the character, like, you know, because obviously, like, he isn't actually in a wheelchair in real life. So, like, especially when he's in another scene later on, it was like, wow. Oh, I mean, enough respect for there, Corey Hart. Yeah.
I'm just picturing him sitting in his wheelchair and he's got like a stack of school books and he's like, oh, and he's like working out, like trying to get his arms ready.
Yeah. It's very impressive because it's like as a 41-year-old fat man or 42-year-old fat man, I can't do half of that shit and I have my legs. And so it's like, I would be screwed if I was in his position.
Yeah, me too.
Jane is super pissed. She storms off. And then as she's hiding in the bushes, cleaning herself up, she overhears a conversation between a stray woman and man that wander over. She's pregnant is the gist of it. She doesn't outright say it, but the guy says to her, it's I can't even say it. It's your oven, but it ain't my bun. You got bacon in there. Oh my God. It's horrible.
Oh, I love it. I was thinking, like, just how random that little bit was. Like, and obviously it comes into it later on. But I was thinking, like, you know, what's the point of that? You know, basically. So yeah, obviously it's not too late that we see her again.
I was also a bit confused by it because I wondered if she's overhearing her mum. But is this a mum in a secret tryst with someone in Britain? And then I realised, oh no, she's a lot younger. It's not a mum. But yeah, that's what hurt me first. Thoughts were on it.
Oh yeah, I'm wildly interested in your thoughts on a lot of this random stuff because this was your first time watching it.
Yeah.
Whereas I've seen it 100 times, so it's a little different. So then in the car ride home, Jane's mom chews her a new one. She is so mad yelling at Jane for being upset with Marty because of what happened at the picnic. And I just love that the mom, in not a convincing way, says, "You just want to be quiet or I'm going to smack you." How many times does she smack Jane and like threaten to hit her?
It's so bad, isn't it? I mean, like, this poor girl, she's literally like a slave, and then if she don't go and do basic things, then she gets beat at the same time. It's just like, God, what an upbringing. She still finds love for her, but oh God, I'd have been gone. She's 15. Go find some money, move to the city, get sent out of there.
And the movie's just cut short because we come home and see Jane's packed a bag and she's leaving.
Yeah.
Roll credits. So at home, Jane helps Marty out of the car and she very meanly tells him, very harshly, Uncle Red, who is a chronic drunk, is still coming to visit, but he's getting a divorce. Apparently that's shocking and upsetting to Marty, but this is like, as we learn later, his like third divorce or something.
Yeah.
Uncle Red.
He comes across as a guy who just doesn't give a shit about divorce.
Right. But it matters because Marty clearly looks up to Uncle Red. So that night, Marty goes into Jane's room and slips her some change to buy a new pair of pantyhose. And this is a girl thing. I laughed because I was like, $1.49? You are not buying pantyhose for $1.49 today, sir. That blew my mind.
This is 1976, don't forget.
That's right.
Sharks of the corn? Virus shark? Cocaine shark? Sharktopus? Yeah, those are all real movies. Join me, Steve Coates, as each week I take a comedic look at the bizarre world of sharksploitation cinema on Bucket of Chum, the Shark Movie Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Truly Unique Jewelry. You're a one-of-a-kind, so it's unique, spelled Younique. With all of the jewelry options mass-produced for each season, you're left wanting more when it comes to pieces that showcase your individual style. Head over to trulyuniquejewelry.com and scroll through handmade one-of-a-kind options for every budget, with pieces starting under a dollar. Beautiful costume jewelry to fit every age and every budget. Custom orders are also available for no additional charge, and they flat rate ship so you can fill your jewelry box with matching pieces for every outfit in your closet for one shipping fee. From earrings to bracelets to necklaces, even rosaries and combination sets. Cost is no longer a barrier to having the looks that you want that scream uniquely you. Go to the Facebook page for Truly Unique Jewelry for updates and discount information when you follow the page. Feel good about supporting a small business while you're updating and expanding your jewelry collection, adding pieces for every occasion. Visit trulyuniquejewelry.com. And remember, it's unique spelled Younique. And now, back to the show.
So that night, we cut to that pregnant woman from earlier sitting at her home with her, I guess, mother downstairs playing the piano. She's up in her room taking mouthfuls of pills, which we assume she's going to OD. And again, we know only this information because she's talking to herself. Nobody in the room. What I laughed at too was the 8x10 headshot on her dresser of the man that was, you know, who she's having an affair with. And it clearly looks like his headshot, like from IMDb.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
It's like prop, not even a picture of the two of them.
Prop department spawn at spare no expense on that.
Posing with his thumb on his chin.
So the werewolf busts in from outside. It's raining and yucky out. He just comes flying through that window. Second story room, slashes her to pieces.
I have a problem with this scene. I want to see if anyone else has a problem with this scene.
Well, we don't get to see any of the real slashing and attacking, but we do see a lot of blood. And then the final shot is her dead on the bed when her mother comes in.
My problem with the scene was the werewolf climbing up to get to the top floor. I've tried climbing those things. And I'm just a grown-ass man.
Have you?
How the hell? Yeah, it's like, how the hell? Yeah, I've done this. How the hell is a werewolf going to climb up that without busting the whole thing or making any kind of noise whatsoever? This seems like poor planning all around. Writers, directors, the werewolf himself should have stepped in and said, like, I don't know, guys. This doesn't feel like a good move to me.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And where's the momentum to come crashing through like that? I mean, what was he swinging in like Tarzan? Yeah, I mean, he's literally flat to the house. I mean, where is the momentum?
He leaves a perfect werewolf shape, well, bear shaped hole as he leaps through the windows, doesn't it? Almost.
You're right. It looked like a Looney Tune, like when you come through the wall.
It's funny though. You say about you didn't see like on the. I bought the DVD to add to the collection, and there was actually quite a lot of like. Chlorine onto skin and stuff like that. So I don't know if you saw that as well, or is that a different version?
What I saw was you would see the wolf like tear through her nightgown, like he's slashing her, but you don't see any gore. Like he doesn't go into her skin and like actually practically gouge her. You just see the surface level scratches and some blood.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It kind of similar then. Like it showed you like it. I thought the actual. I thought it was quite a graphic attack. Yeah, it was actually done quite well. Being like, obviously, we've seen the head being lobbed off already. And then it's like not long after, we've got another kill. And it's quite, you know, quite aggressive, violent. So, to be fair, I didn't mind this scene. I thought as a kill and as an attack, It was quite impressive. I also found out the snarling noise that it was making was the same one used in American Werewolf in London as well. Like they just literally just like nicked the sample.
Of course they did.
Yeah.
That's okay though. I'll forgive it because it works a little. It makes it more more scary. I also like that you don't really get to see the face of the werewolf in this scene. So you're still on a first time watch, probably especially Dave. You're still not laughing at the design yet because you don't know.
No, although we do get a couple of shots of the eye. I think they spent a lot of money on the eye movements, didn't they? So they definitely showcased that.
You weren't put off by that?
No. I'm still intrigued to see how this beast was going to really look when he's finally confronted.
The next day now, we get Sheriff Holler in his office, and that is the fantastic Terry O'Quinn from The Stepfather. He's done a lot. Lost, he was on.
Yeah.
I think in this movie, he's not given good material to work with. He was a slave to the script, unfortunately, because I love him. He's amazing. But in this, it's like, ooh, wah, wah. Like some pretty bad stuff, choices he makes and bad stuff he says. I blame that on the script.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Terry O'Quinn. Like I say, it is quite a reassuring presence. Like, you know, it comes across where he's literally like, look, I'm on my own here. I've got this freaking douchebag as a freaking psychic.
No, it's that fucking bar antagonizing the locals, isn't it? That's all he does.
I mean, giving us more work to do. Spike, you know, we're solving crimes here, and you're like, pissing about these guys in a bar. But Terry O'Quinn, he plays it. I thought he really suited it. Like you say, I don't think he was, like, the script was great, and I don't think he was given like enough screen time either, to be fair, because I love him in Stepfather. I mean, that is just like, you know, that's such a great film. He plays it amazing. But yeah, great entrance. And it was on the phone, weren't it? And they were giving some shit to a detective. I liked how his partner was like, hey, man, like, do you think you should have like said that to him? And it was like, oh, yeah, I made sure he hung up first kind of thing. You know what I mean? Like basically giving loads of shit. Basically,
at the end of the conversation, he's all, fuck off.
Told detective to fuck off. Like, well, yeah, he hung up first. You know what I mean? Like,
But again, somebody having to point out to us that they've called in reinforcements. It's the detectives who are going to come help solve the murders that are happening because they're not equipped. But the Daffy deputy says, you know, should you have told the detective from the Smokey Bear division, blah, blah, blah. Like he had to like spell out so we know who he was talking to. Because, you know, if you're just sitting talking with your friend like that or whatever, your coworker, you're not spelling out all the words like that. It's not natural. I think that's what I'm trying to say. The script, a lot of the conversations aren't natural.
No. We've got to obviously tell the audience who's who or what's happening. Like we haven't got brain cells ourselves to figure stuff out.
Right. So now down at the local bar where the deputy likes to hang out, we've got the local town bully who I guess owns the sporting gear and gun shop in town because we see him later doing that. But he's this big, loud blowhard of a man spouting off insults like he's in elementary school. His insults are so terrible. He says the sheriff couldn't find his own ass if someone rammed it full of radium and gave him a Geiger counter. What?
Who talks like that?
Is he 11? Like Marty? Like, what the hell?
Yeah, I find out that the bar is Owen's Bar, and it was named after Stephen King's son. All right, so his name's Owen. Cool. Yeah, so like nice little wink there. But yeah, like I say, like it's a great scene, and I love seeing Lawrence Tierney, you know, the from Reservoir Dogs. You know, he's such a great character in Tierney, and he's got his baseball bat Peacemaker written on it. I mean, that just says it all. Right, great little thing there.
That's a great touch to this movie. That's one of my favorite things. So the bully is spouting off and the deputy, and they're getting into it. And to me, all signs point to that this is not the first incident like this. Like they probably do this nightly at the bar, just get into it, right? Like this is their thing. But another patron there chimes in and gives Andy some shit about his back taxes or something. And he gets, they're going to get into a fight, like fisticuffs. So the bartender puts his baseball bat between them to stop them and tells them to cool their thermostats or something.
Yeah. Great little line. I love it.
That's the best line. I totally want to say that to people. I never have a reason to because I don't break up fights, but that's a good one. But yeah, we see his baseball bat has the peacemaker carved in it. And I was like, ooh, I've got a bat, but I'm not going to carve into it because it's a collectible. But I really want to.
So that'll be a cool collectible for any movie. But like, you know, you could have it alongside like Negan's from Walking Dead. A triple bill with Harley Quinn. Just have like three baseball bats on your wall. That'd be awesome.
I'd have to wonder though about you if I walk into your house and I see that on your wall as your feature wall. Weapons of the movies. Okay, I gotta go. So the next day, the kids are getting out of school, as we find out, for summer break. So around June, we see Marty's wheelchair is called the Silver Bullet. Now it all makes sense. Of course, there's the title. Well, mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense, but we get to know that.
Yeah, it was throwing me. The fact, why is it called Silver Bullet? Is it a werewolf film? Is it just based on this supercharged motor wheelchair that he's got? Crazy.
Oh, I love it when it gets souped up. This version is just a little bland, regular old little motorized wheelchair. His friends, Brady, are there. Oh, and Tammy, a girl that lives in town that I guess Marty has a crush on. And she maybe likes him too, because she jokingly calls him a booger. word again.
Oh, what? God.
So Marty escorts Tammy home. She's riding her bike. And along the way, they pass by the house where that pregnant lady had been murdered. It's all police tape and police presence. This spooks Tammy out. She tells Marty she's been hearing noises at night on her property. And when they get there, Tammy's dad comes outside and yells at her to get inside. And then he mumbles to himself, but so we can hear him, "Damn cripple always ends up on welfare."
And then he finishes off, "I'll electrocute them all."
And balance the budget.
Yeah, especially about it. Literally looks like he's on welfare.
As he's drinking his beer on the middle of a weekday.
Yeah, it's like, what the hell? When I saw his motorized wheelchair, though, obviously it shows you a little bit later, but I was like, how much must this cost to run? Like, you know, it's all right just pouring like petrol, you know, gas or whatever in this thing. It's got gears and everything because it's got a clutch. Like, I mean, it's a full blown motorbike. It's like full, like every year you got to service it and everything. I mean, what his parents must go through, like, to pay for this chuffing motorized wheelchair.
Well, it does. It does take gas and oil, because he rolls up to the filling station, and the guy there, they go through this a lot. Clearly, he knows Marty, and he jokes with him, "You want me to check the driver's bullshit level?" Because he's going to put gas in it. He asked if he should check the oil. So clearly Marty gets it checked out and tuned up,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, who's paying for that? The parents obviously are paying for it.
I mean, how much does it take as well? Because there's only so much free gas that you can give somebody. Like, where it's come out, like, yeah, come on, Marty. Like, yeah, this is getting a bit regular now. You're going to have to stop paying for this shit now, you know?
Maybe he is paying for it himself. Maybe this is like the first instance of Uber, and he's like giving people rides across town, doing his own little version of DoorDash.
Just sit on his lap or what? How did they get around?
Yeah, totally.
So now we get to meet Uncle Red. This, for me, is where the movie really is fun. So at Marty's house that night, Uncle Red is there. He and Marty are playing poker for baseball cards, I guess. Is that what they're doing? I guess. I like that Uncle Red also is drinking his Wild Turkey straight from the bottle.
Yeah.
Just not a care given.
I love this scene. I think it's hilarious. And it's just Gary Busey, just he plays these crazy, like, lovable characters so well that you can't help but just, you just get enthralled when he's on screen.
The introduction to him is the Jackass joke. To this day, I use that joke because it's so good.
There's a guy sitting in the bar. The bartender says, "Hey, Jackass, give me a drink." So the bartender pours him a drink. He drinks it, sits there for a while, says, "Hey, Jackass, pour me another drink." So he pours another drink. The guy gets up and leaves. The guy that's sitting there says, "Hey, why do you let him call you Jackass all the time?" The bartender says, "Oh, he always called me that."
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. The best thing about it, though, he literally looks like he's drunk for real. Like that is real whiskey. Just the way he is with his mannerisms and that, and he's just all aggressive. His hair's all over. He's all disheveled. He's been drinking all day. This is like real Gary Busey. This is such a great scene. The way he connects with stuff. I read also his son, Jake Busey, who's obviously an actor now. He was on set a lot of the time and become really good friends with Corey Haim, or
Oh.
Haim. And he says that it was being on set with this film where it kind of made him want to become an actor himself, like just hanging around with him and stuff. So yeah, like cool little story. They were like friends for a long time, apparently.
Well, sure, you get to go see your dad be drunk and laughing and making everyone else laugh. Who wouldn't want to get paid to do that? So, as they're playing and joking around and having a good time, the fun killer, Marty's mom, is watching all this and comes in and wants to put the kibosh on it. And what sets her off is just Uncle Red being loud. Piss on the Phillies, piss on the Indians, whatever he's. You would think that she grew up with this man. This is her brother. She would just know to expect that this is what he's like, but she acts super offended. I don't know. It just seemed weird to me. It's like you don't know that this is how Uncle Red is.
Yeah.
Both of the introductions of the mum, really, we've just seen her be pissy with a daughter and then pissy with a brother. So yeah, we're already taking a disliking. Well, I was at this point. I think, God, you're right, miserable bitch. What's
Somebody
she?
needs a spa day.
Yeah, she's got an easy life. She's got a daughter looking after a disabled kid. When she's like at maybe that one day she might be out playing with her friends, she grabs her brother to come in and look after him. She's doing nothing around the house. And where's the dad? Like, you never see him anywhere. He's just chilling in the background. It's like, yeah, it's great. Sleeping
He
with.
knows his wife is insufferable and doesn't want to be around her.
Yeah, it apparently comes once a month. So it's not a shock like to her, just how he is and his reactions and just his whole persona of everything. And so I don't know why she was giving him such shit when this is who he is, like, and she knows that.
So Marty's mom comes in and puts the kibosh on it. Like I said, she grabs Marty and sends him off to bed, but she puts him in this motorized wheelchair on the wall situation to go up the stairs, which is like right out of Gremlins. I just wanted it to like shoot up the stairs. But it made sense. I was like, yeah, they'd probably have that for him. So that's okay. I'm okay with that. But then she turns around and lays into Uncle Red and just goes to like bitch level 10, like goes off on him. Then she just walks away like mic drop, walks away. And Uncle Red says to himself, under his breath, another wonderful night at Sister Nan's. And that tells us, oh, he's used to this. He knows he's going to act up. She's going to give him shit. Like, this is their dynamic. So he
Yeah,
knows that they're this way.
totally. Yeah, I think that's
So,
it. I was
what?
expecting as well for him to shout the daughter down or something to get like Marty on her shoulders and just carry him upstairs rather than wow, they're actually considerate enough to buy one of these things for the house, So yeah, it was nice to see.
What you didn't see that she's upstairs operating it manually.
Crank.
Yeah.
She doesn't miss arm day.
I really want to see that now with her having to carry him up the stairs and he's like on her back like Yoda and she's like Luke and she's doing the flips and shit to get up there.
So then we cut now to Tammy's dad watching and driving. Dave, you got to help me with this. NWA wrestling and having some beers, and he's yelling at the TV. Was that a real thing, since you're a wrestling guy?
Yeah, I actually most of my research was on this because it bothered me because it's especially like once I learned it was the 70s, I was like, okay, well, this town is supposed to be in Maine, which is usually like WWF territory. And then I looked it
Okay.
up, it's like, well, WWF did become part of the National Wrestling Alliance in the 70s, but still they would not be having that program on at the night. It's like usually Saturday mornings is when you're watching wrestling. So they got that wrong. And then
Interesting.
I think essentially what happened is, like I said, this is all 80s stuff. The cars, all the setting is the 80s. They just went to the National Wrestling Alliance, got some tape from their catalog, and threw it on. And this is like an 80s match.
Is Rebel, was he a real wrestler? Because he yells at the TV, come on, Rebel.
I've never heard the name Rebel, but I mean, like going okay. back into like, you know, the 70s and 80s, there's a lot of people I don't know. There could have been like, you know, Jack and Jim or, you know, like Nancy Boy Nan or something like that. I have no idea. There's all kinds of people.
Okay. Being that you're a wrestling fan, I was hoping you'd have some insight. So that's okay. That's cool to know some of that. For me, I know nothing of that, except I just laugh because there's a scene where one of them hurts another wrestler. And the guy watching the TV, he just goes, oh, that hurts my parts.
Very exciting match. We have one of the young lions in there, Brian Adidas.
Come on, Rebel. We're going to bust him up tonight. We're going to kick some ass. We're going to kick some ass. Ow. Oh, yeah, Rebel Airplane. Ow, oh, that's it. Oh, that hurts my parts.
I cannot tell you how many times in real life somebody does something and I just go, oh, that hurts my parts, and nobody gets it. I get it. I laugh.
I say you'll get that one person, and then that, you know, instantly you have that bond for life, that somebody knows what you're on about.
Right. So in the middle of all this, he gets distracted because he hears noises outside. So he goes out to his little greenhouse shack situation he has in the back there. He grabs a gun off his wall and goes to investigate. And he's talking to himself out loud the entire way. I'm guessing because he's drunk. I don't know. It's just weird. Walking with the gun is, I'm going to shoot you. You're interrupting me. You're like my wrestling. And
it's like no one's allowed any silence in this movie at all. It's like, what's up? Just like being with your thoughts. Everyone just talks out loud all the time. I suppose it just makes for a busier town, I suppose. Just everyone walking about, talking out loud.
It's going to make things really weird if you're in the bathroom and like you got the guy next to you in the stall and he's just like describing what's going on. You're like, all right, dude, I don't need the play-by-play.
So we get a couple of suspenseful minutes, actually, shot fairly well, of him lurking around. We get some jump scares, a spider and some other things. And we see eyes under the floorboards. And somehow the werewolf manages to shake the entire building, the entire thing. From underneath? I don't understand that.
I wrote the exact same thing. And also, like, is the green hat or the shed or wherever it is it on some sort of, like, massive platform? Like, because it's like, how does he fit underneath the shed? Like, you know, to be scouting around like that.
That's what I didn't understand either.
Yeah, it's not really that well set up on that. You know, they've obviously got an idea in the head. Not really thought it through, like, practically. But, yeah, we'll just go with it anyway. But yeah, the shaking thing, I think it would have had just as much impact without the shaking.
Oh yeah, they had to have the opening because he has to bust up through the floor for this big dramatic thing where he kills the dad and pulls him down. I do like this movie has practical effects.
Mm-hmm.
And we do get to see him sort of get impaled on one of the floorboards. That's a great shot for me anyway.
Yeah, we also see the pillow off his bed that's underneath his shirt at the same time. It was like, oh, that's kind of ruined it. Just a bit of extra padding in case it really hurt him for real.
Still fun though. You got some blood, you know, and the look on his face. But yeah, so then he's dead ski. Down he goes. So this made me laugh. We cut to a front page of a newspaper. Someone's holding a newspaper and it goes by pretty quick, but I paused it so I could look. It says September 8th, 1980 is the date on the newspaper. No, it's supposed to be 76. And we're filming in 84. So this was a choice. They made it say 1980. I don't know why.
No, that's crazy.
And if the timeline weren't messed up enough already, we're now thrown with cheer into that. Excellent.
And it's 4th of July. In a couple of weeks, but yet it's September 8th somehow.
Yeah. Oh, they were not counting on like people pausing that scene at all, were they? Like, yeah.
No.
They've had a newspaper hidden somewhere for 4 years to like use as a prop. Like, yeah, it's just like...
That's what I'm saying. It was a choice.
That's crazy.
Dave, you were just talking off mic about how I drive in Dave, how I pick apart movies, but this is fun for me. I love to like pause it. Like they never expected somebody to pause the movie and figure that out. That's half the fun for me.
No, like there's never been any set designers or directors or, you know, continuity people ever just like sitting around being like, you really think one of these days Movie Miss is going to do a podcast and it's going to pause every single time to point out all of your mistakes. Like, no, that'll never happen. I don't picture that.
Well, they're relying on VHS being the, you know, that's the technology of the future. So it's like you pause a VHS, you get lines everywhere. You're not seeing anything clear anyway. Like they're
That's a really good
expected.
point.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time I watched something on a VHS tape. I wish I still had a player. But yeah, that's a good point. It did get like wavy lines that kind of moved in place, if
Yeah.
that makes sense, and like obscured the picture, right?
Well, I've got one, and it keeps chewing with tape. Like, you know, it's so much being a VHS collector in modern day, like, because it's if anything goes wrong, nobody knows how to fix it. So you literally, like, you're scouting YouTube to find these obscure videos of some guy who's like, yeah, this is how you fix VHS player. And it's just, God, it's so frustrating. I just got my dad doing it when I was a kid, you know what I mean? So it's like, now I've got to learn for myself.
We figured all that shit out when we were young, how to fix also the audio tapes by using the pencil to wind them back up when the cassette tape would run out. You know, we figured it out.
Yeah.
Okay, so the men reading the paper also hear on the radio that there's now a 5 p.m. curfew because of the maniac who's on the killing spree. Then we see the mayor, and he's asking the sheriff if he has any leads, and the sheriff says, I'm working on it. Then we go into crack police work. Then we go into this bizarre music, not quite fitting for the scene, I thought. And we see montage of people getting scared and running home, locking their doors. The blowhard bully guy, like I said, it runs the gun shop. He's putting a sign up for like Remington shotguns for sale. And I remember reading somewhere in the trivia, and I didn't write it down. I wish I would have, that the model of Remington he's advertising in the window isn't what was available in 1976, and so that's a mistake as well.
Stephen King's quite well known though for getting a lot of technical things wrong in his storytelling anyway. He's never accurate with types of guns and models of guns and things like that. So that'll probably his input on the script.
So would you say that that's frustrating, or is it a charm that he has? Is it charming?
I think it's a cocaine.
And I suppose it depends what part of like the US you live, I suppose, or you know, where folks like, you know, are literally watching films to just for like gun porn or something. You know, it's like, you know, just yeah, let's see how it goes.
So we see everybody's trying to adhere to the curfew, but not Marty and Brady. They're out in the park flying kites. Big fun when you're 11, I guess, right? So Jane rides up on her bicycle and tells Marty dinner was ready an hour ago. I'm like, well, it's not, it's like just curfew. It's just 5 o'clock. You guys eat dinner at 4 p.m. Not typical here, but okay. So she's pissed. Dinner's been ready for an hour at 4 o'clock. She helps Marty out of the tree. This scene, they should not have shown this,
No.
No.
right?
Yeah, it makes no sense. I mean, like you say, he's got up there to get this kite, and then he's kind of like, oh, will you help me get it down? Well, you didn't think that far ahead, where it's like, well, actually, I've got to get back down from the tree once I've got my kite. Yeah, so, you know, so what was he going to do without his sister being there? And the distance from the chair to the tree. I mean, how the hell did he get up in the first place? You know, it makes no sense.
We've already established that Brady's a complete enough to dickhead, so he were never going to help him, was it? So
That was my question, is why the fuck isn't Brady in the tree? He's
he's
a
flying
dickhead.
his kite. He's having the time of his life.
Yeah, totally. No, but
So
yeah, like you say, it's curfew time as well. I was confused, like, because is it afterwards where it then cuts to everybody being in the bar when they should actually be at home in the curfew, or
yes.
like,
Yeah.
and then the police actually come in to talk to everybody, not like, what the hell are you doing here? But just like meeting up for beers. You know, it's
just so Andy can get off some more insults. They're in the bar, and he's like, the sheriff shouldn't even be a dog catcher for poodles because he's so terrible, or some nonsense, some crazy insult. Why aren't you guys home having dinner? It's curfew. Yeah. Oh, then we get another insult, another third grade level insult, because he says that the sheriff's investigation of these murders has been about as efficient as a screen door on a submarine.
Oh, God.
What?
No cutting.
I'm guessing y'all had better insults when you were 12 than this grown man yeah. has. These are terrible.
Yeah, we called everyone boogers.
According to this movie, that's a bad insult. So the deputy is here also after curfew. Shame on him. And before the men can get into a fight, Brady's dad comes in. And I had to write down his name, Kent Broadhurst. This man is the only one in this movie who's trying to put together an Oscar sizzle reel. This man, especially after Brady's death, we'll get to it. Yeah. This man is swinging for the fences. Like, he doesn't know what movie he's in, I don't think.
Yeah.
Did you love this guy? I love this guy.
Oh, God, yeah. I've literally wrote, every scene he was in. He is incredible. Like, it's almost like all the rest of the cast are kind of like in awe and they're just like stood in silence. It's like, man, this guy can act. He's putting his own to shame. You know, he finishes his line and then it's almost like they forget to even speak themselves because they're in such awe of him. Yeah.
What did distract me a little bit from his entrance, though, where it looks like he's wearing a bald cap. I just weren't convinced that that was his natural hairline. So then I found every other scene he was in that I was checking to see whether that was it actually is.
A very, very odd hairline. Agreed. Looked fake.
I'll be part of his method acting. You know, he took this role really serious. I think this guy should be semi-bald. Have tufty bits of hair around the sides. Yeah, because I think that's the kind of dad he would be in this situation.
What is your thought process that you're like, this is the haircut this man would have? Okay. Well, it works for him. Because like you said, he's convincing as hell. He's in there distraught looking for Brady and everyone is like silent, like, uh-oh, something's wrong. Then we immediately cut. Now it's pitch dark outside and the sheriff is in the park carrying a bloody kite, Brady's kite from earlier. We have a gorgeous shot of a gazebo out in the park there, but it's overshadowed by the fact that there is a covered dead body laying in it, which is Brady. I was a little disappointed, though, when the dad shows up and he runs over there to look at the body to confirm that it's Brady. And his reaction, again, Oscar worthy. But we don't get to see the carnage, which as a horror fan, that's what I want.
So we found a little interview. It's on YouTube from that actor. It's like a snippet from Blu-ray that's been released. And he explains that whole scene. So, yeah, he basically turns up at so the film in, it's 2 a.m. in the morning, and the prop guys who were supposed to have done this, this mangled body kid and stuff, they basically turn up, drop it off, and then, just basically piss off. And the director's like, what the frick am I supposed to do with this? The actor says it looked like a mannequin had been smashed with a hammer and drizzled with cranberry juice. It says it was just the worst prop that you could imagine. So the director was like, really,
he was distraught. He was like, I'd be embarrassed if we'd commit this prop to film. But then this is where this guy really, what you joked about him going for the Oscar, he literally said, well, I saw this as my opportunity. And I told the director, look, don't worry, put the camera on me. I'll give you everything you need for this scene to convey the feeling. Don't worry about that prop. I'll save this movie for you. I'm so proud of this moment.
Yeah, he saved the day. He did everything. And the director was like, wow, thanks, man. Like, you saved the day. It's amazing. So we don't have to show this crappy prop of a dead body. That's why it was just pure raw emotion from the actor.
That's insane. My mind is blown.
At this point, all the behind the scenes shit makes me want to see a movie about the making of this movie. I think it would just be amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, the more you read about some of the stuff behind, I'd love to see a making of documentary of this movie.
We know Brady's dead now, so we cut to the memorial service at the church being presided over by the good Reverend Lowe. Uncle Red takes a flask out of his jacket. And then decides he probably shouldn't have a little nip while he's sitting in church and puts it away.
I love it.
Reverend Lowe says that Brady's parents, this is so weird, you guys. Tell me if you think this is weird. Brady's parents want me to say a few words of comfort to you all. But then he says, the face of the beast always becomes known and the time of the beast always passes. Are you comforted when I say that to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It really puts me at ease hearing them words.
I can't sleep at night until I hear those words.
My mum used to put me to bed with them, that exact same phrase. Yeah,
kiss on the forehead.
Yeah. Now, sleep dreams. Now, sweet dreams, little child.
Don't worry. The beast is not going to come for you. Thanks, Mom. Now I can sleep. So cut to after service. Marty's going to hitch a ride home with old Uncle Red in his little convertible car. I just love this. It's such a sweet scene. They're just zipping along down the road, having uncle nephew time. And they have the wheelchair like strapped to the top of his car. And I was waiting for it to fall off. Yeah, this thing, he needs an upgrade. So thank God Uncle Red comes through. On the drive home, they chat. Marty says maybe the killer is not a man, but a monster. Maybe even a werewolf. Obviously, we needed him to come to that conclusion immediately because of how the movie is paced, and we got to hurry up and get to the werewolf part. But that seemed like a big stretch.
It does.
Very specific.
Right?
You know what I mean? Yeah,
thought it was like, a vampire.
No. It's like, well, how has he come to that conclusion? On what evidence? You know, he's just a child going to school. I mean, what the hell has he been reading or seeing? It's just makes no sense. But I do love like how like Red is just literally like, yeah, you're talking shit, kid. Like, you know, bunch of psychos out there and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, it's a werewolf. Like, listen to me. And it's like, it's a great connection. Yeah. It's funny to see, I've got to say.
So then we cut now away from that to Blowhard Andy getting his posse all riled up at the bar. They're going to set out with their guns and hunt down the psycho. Now, I didn't understand this either, because at this point, they just think it's this person, this man who's going around killing people, a psychotic human. Why are you going to go in groups through the woods like you're hunting wild animals? You think this man who's a serial killer is out traipsing through the woods at midnight for no good reason, like waiting?
Why are they waiting for nightfall to go out on this big hunt for a psycho?
It's like, what's stopping them from thinking it's one of them in the bar themselves? You know, so it's like they're all going out in a big group. And how do they know what? They're just not going to get wiped out by one of the blokes that's in there every night. So it's... yeah, it's a bit of a strange one, to be fair. That kind of whole build up, and obviously Brady's dad's there as well.
The sheriff tells him, go home. You can't do this. You can't go out and just private justice and find this guy.
Private justice. That is the lamest. When it says there's a name for this, I'm thinking, yeah, vigilantes or something. It's like, well, private justice. What the fuck?
You could make a drinking game out of this scene alone with just the words private justice.
Yeah.
So Andy, the bully, tells deputy he's a fat shitbag, calls him useless. More juvenile insults. You couldn't catch a cold, he tells the sheriff. I swear to God, this guy's got a book at his house where he comes up with these in the middle of the night and he writes them down. I've got a good insult for the next time I see the sheriff.
Yeah, it's just stealing his child's little book of insults, isn't it? It's like, yeah, wait till I see the guys at bar tomorrow, this corker.
He lives for it, clearly.
Yeah.
Andy, again, is ranting. He's told to shut up by Brady's dad, who's been standing in the back observing. And I think it's weird that he's got the, I don't know, not balls, but like, he feels like he has the right to step up to the sheriff and get in his face just because his kid was killed. Like, this is the law. This is the sheriff, and he's trying to find the murderer as best he can. But he feels like because he gives this compelling Oscar-worthy speech, that justifies everybody taking off and ignoring the sheriff's word to go home and you all are breaking the law. What?
I just came from my boy's funeral. I know how upset
How grief-stricken you must be.
He was torn apart.
I know that. I'm
upset. Grief-stricken?
You don't know what those words mean.
My son was torn to pieces.
Pieces?
My son was torn to pieces! You come in here and talk to these men about private justice. You dare to do that. Why don't you go out to Harmony Hill and dig up what's left of my boy Brady and explain to him about private justice? Would you want to do that?
As for me, I'm going to go out and hunt up a little private justice.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. Like the bartender, you know, the Lawrence Tierney, you can see he's kind of like on the fence. He's like, yeah, the sheriff's right. We shouldn't really be doing this. And then obviously he comes out of the shadows, like a bit like Jaws style with the nails down the blackboard, and he gives this great speech. And it's like, yeah, works for me. Come on, guys. Like, they'll just clear off, don't they?
Guys, they don't all chant private justice as they're storming out the bar as well.
That was like Evil Dies Tonight. Private justice.
What is it? Like going hunting Frankenstein. Yeah, it sucks.
Right? They just were sans the torches. That's all they needed was the torches.
That's all it was, wasn't it? Small town folk.
I thought it was just ridiculous. It was just, like I said, with the private justice. Every time they said private justice, I was just like expecting like a commercial for like the new hot 80s action flick, you know, coming this summer, Private Justice.
Brady's dad with a cape.
Yeah, I think Gary Hughes actually made that film at some point. I'm sure he has.
So everyone's running out of the bar. We see Reverend Lowe is outside trying to stop them all. We cut now to a bunch of people showing up at the wooded area for their private justice hunting. And all of a sudden, it's really foggy. So I'm wondering how much of their budget went to the fog machines. Because this scene had more fog than the movie The Fog. It is as thick as pea soup when they go in that little clearing area and it's like waist high.
Yeah, waist high.
What is that?
I was hoping you could like maybe like shine some light on that, you know, because like in the UK we don't see fogs in woods like that. So maybe it's a US thing. I'm not sure.
Clearly, it's just a North Carolina thing because it blew my mind.
That's crazy.
So we see two men walking, and one of them steps in a metal bear trap. Is that what that is? A bear trap that gets his ankle?
Yeah, that was a bear trap.
Okay. Because I was like, you need just be worried about if you've had your tetanus shot. Like, and that's your big worry at this point. Not if there's a werewolf out here.
I love the scene just because to me it was like watching the Laurel and Hardy hunting team go out and try and get a werewolf. And just like, what the hell are these idiots doing out there? They don't look like they even know how to shoot a gun.
Or Elmer Fudd, isn't it? I'll get you, you pesky wabbit.
Werewolf. It is, you're right.
Well, they even took time for a bit of comedic effect as well, don't they? Because he opens the bear trap, then gets distracted and lets it shut again on his leg. So it's like, wow.
I winced. I was like, oh, don't do that. Yeah, I felt it. That was actually pretty good.
Did you feel it in your parts?
I felt it in my parts. This movie, I will say, because of some of these lines, is the gift that keeps on giving. Because, man, I never get tired of saying that. So we cut to Andy and about five other people, including the bar owner and his peacemaker. And they enter into that small little clearing, like I said, blanketed with chest-high fog. One of them says he's not scared, but he's acting really scared. And the lady in the group turns to him, the one lady who's there, and asks him if he's gonna make lemonade in his pants.
Yeah.
You couldn't just ask if he's gonna piss himself. No, because this is the script that gave us insults like booger. So of course you're gonna just say, are you making lemonade in your pants?
Come on. I don't know.
What's the matter, Bobby? You're gonna make lemonade in your pants?
I ain't scared.
They're obviously going hunting, but that everybody is literally within like a meter square of one another. It's like there's nobody spreading out, going looking down different areas. So they're all literally going to be like just stumbling among each other and you know, no one's going to be finding anything. It's like, you know, they're all literally...
They're at the end of each other's gun barrels, aren't they, literally?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you're not going to find anything like that.
No, no, this is like the worst search party in the history of search parties. Like, they're going out like, oh, this is going to be like a manhunt, and we're gonna cover like 25 feet and then give up and be like, hey, we did all we could. We tried.
The psycho wasn't out in the woods. Oh, well. But the thing I liked about the scene was, even though you can tell it's a pre-recorded, echoey, creepy sound for the werewolf noise, because he's supposed to be, you know, echoing in the fog, it worked for me. It's creepy to me when they play that noise and you like, they're looking around and you don't know where it is. I don't know. It's a little bit of a freaky scene for me. I think it works in this, what it's supposed to be, a horror movie. So yeah. I want a little bit of horror.
Yeah, totally.
Men start getting attacked because an arm comes out of the fog from below. And then we get what I thought was token black guy, but it's not, because there are two.
Yeah. Oh.
But he gets killed and then thrown against a tree. And then the little squirrely guy from the bar that made a tax joke earlier, he gets killed. And then we see his half mangled head come up out of the fog.
It just literally popped up.
Yeah. It reminded me a bit like that character out of The Blob, you know, in the cinema, where it's like, yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, are you okay? And then like half a face is melted away. But no, it made me laugh, because the first kill, you could tell that the director was like giving him that, saying like, oh, just prepare yourself. Like, you know, we're going to have something jumping out at you at some point. Everyone looked like they were on edge, but because they literally couldn't see when this arm was going to come flying out. And like, it was almost like an actual reaction to be like, oh shit, oh, yeah, there's an arm there. Like, you know, it was like, no one expected this arm to actually come out and grab him. Like, you know, they were just waiting for that one moment. And it was like genuine jumps, as if they, oh, bollocks, like someone under here, oh shit. And then they get chucked away, like, yeah, with rigging. Yeah, it made me quite laugh.
So now Andy and the other black guy that's in the group, we didn't see him before, but he appears, and they start to run off. And the woman and Lemonade Pants guy, they run off the other way. Then the bar owner starts to run off, but he gets swiped by the werewolf. We see a paw just come out. And I love this, because all we see is the bat being held by the man, and it gets two good hits in on the werewolf. But then there's a pause, and you hear noises like they're tussling under the fog. And then the werewolf hand comes up holding the bat, and it starts to get a couple of hits in and obviously kills the guy.
Yeah. Interesting. I can't remember too many bear attacks in the wild where it literally grabs weaponry from its surroundings to like hit and kill campers, general walking and rambling folk. It's a primal kind of animal, and it's using like, it's like, hey, hit me with that bat. Give me that fucking bat. Let me hit you back, you little bastard. You know, and it's like fighting back with its own weapon. It would not do that. It's a freaking werewolf. You know, it thinks like an animal, for God's sake.
Even Cocaine Bear didn't.
It's such a stupid scene, man. Oh, no.
So that's how you know you pissed something off. Like if you go after a werewolf, you know now, don't hit it with a bat, because it's going to come back after you with the bat. So you're going to have the insult of, like, you got beat to death with your own damn bat. That's just like a horrible insult.
Yeah, totally.
So like I said, I've not really been much of the 80s horror fans. I sort of avoided them purposely because I was scared. And more that I am seeing and watching now, I'm getting this realization of these type of films aren't that scary in terms of what I can't justify the fact that I avoided. Probably would have been different had I been 12, 13 and watching these for the first time. But it seemed a bit too, comedic to be something that would make me scared of. I'd not be worried about a werewolf chasing me around with a baseball bat in the fog.
You almost expect, to see him running or the arm through the fog, like the Benny Hill music or something.
Yeah. Oh, you get Benny Hill too. Oh, that's great.
Oh, yeah. So now I'm curious, Dave, what does scare you then? This obviously, you know, years later, 40 years later, isn't scary, but what does scare you?
It's the suspenseful stuff, the stuff that ramps up the anxiety, things like, so.
Okay.
That's the stuff that gets me. I think I've been, as older, when I've seen more of the gore horror films like the things like Hostel and watching the Saw franchise, stuff like that, sort of desensitized to the gore and the blood and the splatter. So some of these practical effects, although I can appreciate the complexity of putting them together, they probably don't have the impact as they would have done if I'd have been watching them with fresh eyes and a younger, less tainted mind.
Okay.
But the suspense stuff is always good. That I'm a terrible jumper. I watch a film on edge. If it's ramping up well, I'll jump 3 feet in the air when they unleash it. So.
Okay. So yeah, this one did not do that to you, I'm guessing.
No.
This is not suspenseful in any way.
No.
I would love to meet like the 13 or 14 year old boy who watched this when it came out and came out like scared, like, oh my God, this movie scared me. And his friends just look at it. What the hell was wrong with you?
You know what though? If my friend was scared by this and I was a child, I would totally do something to freak them out on purpose, like get a bear clock or a baseball bat. Yes, I would fuck with them because it's funny to me.
All right, listeners, that is going to wrap up part one of our discussion on Stephen King's Silver Bullet. If you're interested in checking it out at the time of this recording, it was available pay streaming on Amazon Prime, Max, and Hulu. Be sure to check back next week when we release part two of this really fun episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Oh, that hurts my parts.
Hey, listeners, Drive-In Dave here saying we know you have a lot of options when it comes to podcasts, so we want to thank you so much for listening to ours. Please be sure to follow us on all your social media platforms. Join us in the Bad Movie Conversation. We're on Facebook with a Let's Talk Turkeys page, as well as a discussion group where you can chat with other people who also love bad movies. We're also on Instagram at Let's Talk Turkeys, all one word, plus we're on Twitter with the handle at Gobble Podcast. That's GOBBLEPODCAST. And of course, you can always email us direct at Let's Talk Turkeys, all one word, @yahoo.com.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.